Welcome to this session. We might get started because we've got a few speakers. So it's good to see some familiar faces and many new faces for me anyway. My name is Helen Jarvis, and I started becoming active in issues or even being aware of the issue of Elam Tamils and persecution in Sri Lanka in the 1980s. We had an organisation at that time called Campaign Against Repression in the Pacific and Asia, CARPA. And I see Chris Lee here, who was one of them. I don't know if anyone else here was involved in that. But that was a long time ago, and the issues are still, sadly, still very much with us, and there's been a lot of water under the bridge and a lot of blood spilled in that time since the 80s. We thought it was bad then, but things got so much worse. But here we are today. We are in the just about to commemorate the 10th anniversary of the end of the war, the Mulivaika phase of the war. But of course, as I say, it was a much longer issue and a much longer struggle. But it's still going on. And there's certainly not, in any sense, a destruction of Tamil identity in Sri Lanka, which I think was the intent of the powers that be. But so here today, we are, as we know, meeting on the land of the Wurundjeri people and the Kulin clan, and we want to acknowledge that land was never ceded, and pay our respects to the elders past and present. We have with us today several speakers, and let me first introduce Lee Rhiannon, who probably doesn't need much introduction. In fact, none of the speakers need introduction, I think, to this audience. But Lee was a former federal senator for the Greens, as you would know. She has had a history of working on Sri Lanka and worked on a fact-finding mission in 2013 looking into the treatment and the persecution of the Tamils at that time. She was actually deported from Sri Lanka at that time for looking behind the curtain, as it were. So can we start off by Lee speaking? Then we will have, I'll say a few words myself. Ben Hillier, the editor of Red Flag, will speak, and he is the author of a forthcoming publication about a particular Tamil tiger and the experiences of that person who has now deceased. And finally, Aran Malvagana, who is a founding member of the Tamil Refugee Council, and I'm sure known to everybody in the room. Lee, can you start off, please?
I do acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we meet and pay tribute to their history, their culture, and their ongoing struggle against the injustices, the stolen generations, Black deaths in custody, land theft and the many other crimes Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people across this nation have to deal with often on a daily basis. I also acknowledge that in a few weeks it will be the 10th anniversary of the massacre of tens of thousands of Tamils in the closing stages of the Sri Lankan Civil War. In this talk I will consider the deaths of these people, the many other deaths of so many Tamil people, and the ongoing persecution and suffering of Tamil people in the context of centuries of colonialism in Sri Lanka. I will also touch on the role of international solidarity in supporting communities such as Tamils. The colonial occupation of Sri Lanka by the Portuguese, Dutch and British inflicted centuries of suffering, mass murder and extreme exploitation on local Sri Lankans and Tamil immigrants brought to the island nation to garner wealth for British colonisers and for a few other class Sri Lankan collaborators. Before we delve into this ugly history, I do wish to explain that I'm not saying that peace and justice reigned across Sri Lanka before the arrival of European colonisers. various Buddhist and Hindu leaders imposed feudal relations that also brought great misery. But the divide and rule strategy of successive European colonisers of Sri Lanka massively increased the suffering of local populations, created a culture of brutality that is still impacting on this region, and laid the basis for the crimes that continue to be perpetrated against the Tamil community. I was interested to find out recently that the caste system, still seen by many of us as central to the culture and demographics in this region, was shaped by colonial practices. A 2002 article in Foreign Affairs online website sets out how it was the Portuguese that first suggested caste identities to try and manage the many communal groupings. The British expanded on this idea to promote what they called order, but it was essentially about control, again through divide and rule tactics. This damaging hierarchical structure was codified into law by the British. Now, a quick sketch of colonial occupation of Sri Lanka. The Portuguese arrived in 1504, establishing control around the port of Colombo, for obvious reasons. The Portuguese exercised their control through a policy of aggressive conversion of locals to Catholicism, which include forcing Hindus and Buddhists to adopt Christian names. The 1600s see the Dutch forcibly take over from the Portuguese. By 1660, the Dutch East India Company controlled most of Sri Lanka, and the Protestant Dutch persecuted the Catholic converts and imposed heavy taxes. In the 1700s and 1800s, the suffering of the people of Sri Lanka was exacerbated by European maritime powers going to war over trade routes and colonies. The British emerge as a victor, and now it is the British East India Company that rules Sri Lanka. In 1802, Sri Lanka actually becomes the British Crown's first colony. In the first two decades of the 1800s, Britain waged a number of ruthless and deadly wars in Sri Lanka to control opposition to their occupation. A pattern of barbarity was established. What was inflicted on Sri Lankans at this time is sickening. Now, I'll just give one example. This was at Uva in the southern half of the island. Now, this is what happened when the locals fought back against the British occupiers. The British massacred all the male population above 18 years. They confiscated the properties of the people involved in the uprising. They killed cattle, other animals, burnt homes and other property. Paddy fields and the famous irrigation systems of this area were destroyed. Following these crimes, the colonial governor ordered that the locals be stripped of their land. The land was then consolidated under the process of enclosure. Now, this was a legal measure from England that allowed the Crown to consolidate small holdings into larger farms. This system favoured rich landowners and alienated land that was once common for communal use. The result was extreme poverty across Sri Lanka, as the Tamils and other poorer sections of the society no longer had common land where they could grow crops and run their stock. Then through the 1800s, we see the growth of massive plantations across Sri Lanka, mainly for This drove the development of the island's infrastructure, and there were more waves of Tamils brought in to be cheap labour on the roads and railway projects. The numbers of Tamil labourers working on plantations increased massively at this time. By 1911, 500,000 Tamils, which was about 12% of the population of Sri Lanka, were working on plantations. In the main, these people were indentured labourers. Many now settled permanently onto these big plantation estates, usually living in appalling poverty. The use of indentured labourers is possibly one of the most cruel and ruthless aspects of British colonialism. Indentured Tamil labourers were transported to British colonies and other nations to assist British companies boost their profits in those other colonies. From 1834 to the end of World War I, Britain transported more than 3 million indentured workers from India and Sri Lanka to 19 of their other colonies. These workers suffered shocking hardships. They were made to work under harsh working conditions for very long hours, with few, if any, breaks, and with little sustenance. Many never saw their families again. Tensions between Sri Lankans and Tamils is a clear byproduct of British colonialism. Just 8 years after independence was won in 1948, ethnic riots occurred. The brutal treatments of protesters, unfair laws, and occasional killings increased community tensions and resulted in more protests and riots. The inequality, suffering, and discrimination Tamils were expected to live with strengthened the sense of various militant groups advocating independence for Tamils. In the 2000s, these developments culminated in the civil war between ruling class Sri Lankans and various Tamil groupings. The loss of life was extreme, with more than 100,000 people killed and the forced disappearance of thousands of others. The civil war, as I said, ended 10 years ago in 2009, but there has been no satisfactory resolution. If you're not acquainted with what happened in May 2009, I urge that you read about it and view the film No Fire Zone, The Killing Fields of Sri Lanka. The Sri Lankan government ordered up to 400,000 civilians to gather on the beaches that they said were no fire zones. That's why so many people went there. Once corralled on the beaches, Tamil civilians and Tamil tigers were bombed and shot for days. The United Nations panel found that as many as 40,000 civilians may have been killed in the final months of the war. A Guardian investigation in 2013 put the number up to 70,000. Whatever the numbers were, clearly shocking crimes were committed, but there has been no investigation, and Western countries, including Australia, have been largely silent. The end of the civil war has not improved conditions in Sri Lanka. Poverty has not been reduced, press freedom has not been restored, and the judiciary are under tighter political control. As Helen mentioned, in November 2013, I visited Sri Lanka. This was part of an MP fact-finding mission about the civil war and to hear from Tamils about their demands for an international investigation into the war crimes and the crimes against humanity that occurred both during the civil war and subsequently. I was joined by New Zealand Greens MP, Jan Loki. The Malaysian MP who was to join us was refused a visa. The visit reinforced for me that Australia should not be sending asylum seekers back to Sri Lanka. We heard shocking stories about what happened when they did return. A strong memory of the trip is how the crimes against Tamil people continue. Women are raped, people disappear, and land and homes of Tamil people are being confiscated to this day. We saw the land theft most graphically as we travelled down the east coast. We would regularly come across new army bases where once there were Tamil fishing villages. New Buddhist shrines marked the entries to these army bases. We visited the homes where villagers were displaced to. They now live in wrought iron shacks far away from the coast where they used to fish and farm. They were impoverished. On the last day of our trip, while we were meeting with representatives of human rights groups and other NGOs, police arrived and we were detained. Our detention was actually only for a few hours, but the fear I saw among the people we were meeting with was intense. The event for me was very telling. Jan and I were able to return home. We actually were planning on returning home that day, so being frank about it, it didn't disrupt us enormously. However, what it left is that lasting impression, because for us, we're returning home to our families, our loved ones, how we work. For the Tamils who we were meeting with and their supporters, many Sri Lankans, they have to live with this harassment every day. Back in Australia, when I was an MP, I spoke in Parliament and a number of times about Tamil issues, met with Tamil groups and their support organisations and attended rallies. There are only a few voices for Tamil issues in Parliament. Now, I mention this not to fly my flag, but to highlight that while we want to win more MPs standing up for Tamil demand, that is very necessary. Our main quest must be to build strong public support. Demonstrable public support for the Tamil cause is what will win over more MPs to add their voice to the demands for an international investigation. I do have some further observations that I'd like to share with you about the importance of international solidarity. Over the years, a critical factor in nations oppressed by past and neo-colonialism obtaining their independence has been international solidarity. Stating the obvious, but it's worth saying, it's the action of people in other countries taking a stand with people fighting against exploitation and oppression in all its forms. Nelson Mandela, when he visited Australia, paid tribute to the role of Australian unions and the anti-apartheid movement in this country in helping to build the international campaign for boycotts and sanctions that has played such a critical role in ending the racist apartheid regime. I remember hearing Vietnamese who fought against the US invasion of their country saying how much it meant to them to know that people in other countries were protesting, occupying US government buildings and staging sit-ins in support of the Vietnamese. When it comes to the struggle of the Tamil people, there has been international support. But let's be frank, it has not been huge, and I think that is largely because Tamil Tigers were labelled terrorists. This requires consideration of the role of armed struggle. In making these comments, I wish to emphasise that I'm not promoting armed struggle, but I'm also not promoting a pacifist approach. People fighting colonisers have rights. People like the Tamils, the Kashmiris, the Palestinians, Aborigines in Australia, the Jewish people who resisted the Warsaw Ghetto, the people who fought in the French Revolution had a legal right to resist occupation. This legal right is set out in the 1960 Declaration on the Granting of Independence to Colonial Countries and Peoples and the Fourth Geneva Convention and its subsequent protocols. The United Nations Resolution 37/43, dated 3rd of December 1982, sets out this right. Again, I'm emphasising, because often we know how things are distorted. Again, I emphasise, I'm not advocating armed struggle. That is a decision for those who are occupied. But we need to recognise and respect that armed struggle against occupying forces is a legal right. I mention these facts, which I think are relevant to the status of Tamil Tigers, as they are still classified by some countries and some international bodies as a terrorist organisation. I am also adding that point, because having grown up with the Vietnam War, where we were supporting people who were fighting in armed struggle, and that we weren't actually attacked by that when we were supporting them in that way. But these days I feel the left has been so intimidated by how do we support people like the Kashmiris, like the Tamils, who at different times have used armed struggle, and I think it's something we need to address. Disagreeing with a group because they engaged in armed struggle does not mean that they are automatically a terrorist group. We need to be able to discuss what are the appropriate tactics to advance struggles for a nation's independence. The international left has a responsibility to support the call by Tamils in Sri Lanka and the Tamil diaspora for the war crimes and crimes against humanity committed in the civil war and subsequently to be investigated. We also need to support Tamil demands for justice and recognition within Sri Lanka. And those demands for justice continue in a whole number of ways in Sri Lanka now. Regularly there are protests. Last year in August there was a huge protest in the north of the country with about 4,000 in attendance. They were demanding the return of land that had been confiscated from Tamils by Sinhalese. The end, this is an interesting one, again it reminds me of some of the issues going on in Israel where they make out that they're a great environmental nation because they plant trees. What they're doing in parts of Sri Lanka to the Tamils is saying there's nature reserves here, you can no longer fish in these inland lagoons. So that they use this environmental cover to again exploit and oppress Tamil people. And again, the call at these demonstrations regularly for an independent investigation into the ongoing disappearances. So we really need to add our voice to this call from Tamil people. And if these demands are not achieved, I think it means that the destructive reach of 500 years of colonialism is still bringing havoc and hardship to Tamil communities around the world. But I am an optimist. international solidarity has a fine place in the Australian left, and I think it's something that we need to revive and work closely with Tamil communities so that demands for justice are met. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Lee, not only for this lightning travel over such a historical period and so many issues, but also specifically, I think, focusing on the role of international solidarity and the important continuation of it. I was asked to come along and chair and to say a few words today because I was a judge in the Permanent People's Tribunal hearing on Sri Lanka, just after Lee was there. So they were had their fact-finding mission in November 2013, and in December 2013, we held a panel of judges from the Permanent People's Tribunal. The panel, this particular panel, was on the issue of genocide. Was genocide in Sri Lanka, and it was held in Germany, in Bremen. The sponsors of the tribunal were the International Human Rights Association of Bremen and the Irish Forum for Peace in Sri Lanka. They held a first session hearing of the Permanent People's Tribunal in 2010, which made findings of crimes against humanity and war crimes. But they said they did not have enough time to consider, and there was not enough evidence brought forward to consider the question of genocide, which required a more intensive investigation and legal analysis. And so the second session was called. I'll just step back 1 minute to say what is the Permanent People's Tribunal, because many of you may not. But it was founded in 1979, but it grew out of tribunals that were held in the 1960s, known at that time as the Russell Tribunals, Bertrand Russell tribunals on Vietnam in the 60s, and then in the early 70s also on the dictatorships in Latin America and South America. And Bertrand Russell and Jean-Paul Sartre convened these people's tribunals, saying that the states were creating the crimes, committing the crimes, and why should we leave questions of justice in the hands of the states? It should be the people who should judge what the states are doing. It's quite a controversial framework, but the Permanent People's Tribunal was established afterwards in Rome. Its headquarters are in Rome. And it continues today. It's had more than 50 sessions around the world on specific issues that are brought forward by communities that are suffering persecution from the state. And it has also not just been on question of human rights and similar persecutions that we would be discussing in the case of Sri Lanka, but also more systemic persecutions and infringement in terms of the structural framework of the World Bank, the IMF, multi-pharma, big pharma, projects of railways and mining and so forth. So there's a number of different aspects. Fracking has been a recent one, and the most recent one they've held has been on the case of refugees. They had about five or six hearings through Europe, so focusing on the rights of refugees that are being infringed daily, of course. So that was why I was asked to speak. In our tribunal in Bremen, we did reach a finding that the genocide had been committed. I thought it was very important that Lee started with the historical analysis, which is exactly what we did also in Bremen, where we came up with the referred to tension between Tamils and Sri Lankans is a clear byproduct. Tamils and Sinhalese is a clear byproduct of British colonialism, and that was indeed the same perspective that we had in Bremen, where we formulated. We formulated it as the logical manifestation of the structural genocidal and colonial period and the constitution of the newly independent state. So we indeed went back to look at some of the legal framework that was established and the economic framework that Lee pointed to through the colonial period. And that was, at the time when we brought it forward, was considered somewhat controversial because many people wanted to see what was going on in Sri Lanka as simply a Sinhalese aberration or ethnic persecution, historical enmities, ancient hatreds, that framework of analysis. So we looked at it very much in terms of the colonial constructs that were built there. We were also asked to look at complicity. So we were asked was genocide committed? We said yes, by the Sri Lankan state. And complicity, we were asked to rule on complicity by UK, US and India. In our findings, we said that yes, we thought all three were complicit, but we specifically found the US and the UK guilty of complicity and aiding and abetting the genocide, not only for the colonial period, but what had happened during the post-independence period, and particularly in the 1980s with military intelligence, military support, enormous assistance to the surveillance and repression apparatus that was built in Sri Lanka, and also in the case of the USA, of undermining the peace process that was going on by precisely the labelling of the Tigers as terrorists. And we said that was in itself led to the extreme end of the war. In the case of India, we did not reach a finding. We said we hadn't had enough evidence presented, and there were differing roles over different periods of the Indian involvement, and we left that to one side, although we did certainly criticise the role of India at several particular points along the way. The other point that we looked at was looking at genocide against the national group, and we referred to the national group as the Ilam Tamils. And that, again, there was a lot of legal discussion about that label. And the other thing is we looked at the crimes, the acts of genocide that were committed, and we included the sexual violence and rape as part of it, which is often not included in genocide. And the final thing we did was say that the genocide was ongoing. We weren't looking at a historical event that had ended in May 2009, but was indeed ongoing, as Lee has suggested, continuing genocide. But we said that it's a continuing, but has not yet accomplished the total destruction of the identity of the Ilam Tamils, which is, of course, what was the intention of the perpetrators. So that's just to put in into the context one analysis and one effort of international solidarity that was taken. There are, of course, many others, and attempts at seeking assistance through the UN system, through the International Criminal Court, through other ways which have so far not led to any success at all. But I think that can come in discussion. So we should turn now to Aaron Ben. I've got it wrong. Ben, editor of Red Flags, the next speaker.
Thank you. On the beach in Mulli Vaikal, it's a small stretch of land between the Bay of Bengal and the Nandikal Lagoon in the northeast of the island, in the heartlands of where the Tamil Tigers had their strategic operations. 10 years after, don't do that, 10 years after the fall of the Tigers, 10 years after the end of the bloody war launched by the Sri Lankan military against the civilians, Tiger leadership and craters. 10 years later, if you walk to that beach, you can still see the craters in the ground from the waters. You can still see the remnants of the bunkers that were dug with people's bare hands and whatever hose or pieces of wood or tin they could get to their possession. There are still tangled sari scraps. There are shoes. There are t-shirts. Discarded items. 10 years after a horrific premeditated extermination was unleashed by the Sri Lankan government against a largely defenceless population and the remnants of a Tiger army that by this stage was almost utterly leaderless, headless, and had suffered disastrous losses in the preceding months. This was one of the most horrific genocidal offensives that we've seen in the 21st century, leaving, as Lee said, 40,000, 70,000 dead on the beaches and slightly inland, and tens of thousands of people still unaccounted for, disappeared, for whom the campaigns continue for answers from the government about what exactly happened to people after this offensive had been finished, when people surrendered, were taken in trucks, vans, marched to prison camps, never to be seen again. When you go to this place, despite all of the horror that is still etched into the earth, one of the most noticeable aspects of this area is a large sprawling naval base to the south, covering several square kilometres, one of the largest bases in the country. And it's named after a man called Gotabaya, was the brother of the then President Mahinda Rajapaksa. He was in charge of the armed forces overseeing the genocide, and he now has a base named after him in the homelands of the inland Tamils. The most noticeable thing when you are in the north today is not the existence of dead bodies or mass graves, although the graves are there somewhere. The existence of the military bases everywhere across the north. In some areas, you cannot go 10 kilometres without running into another military installation. And this is a very small island. The island itself of Sri Lanka is about the size of Tasmania, possibly slightly smaller. The Elam homelands in the north and the east constitute maybe 40%, 30% of the total land. But in the north of the country, about 75% of the Sri Lankan military is now stationed. And that's a military that has somewhere between 200,000 and 300,000 soldiers. The great crime that was carried out 10 years ago, of the killings, the disappearance, the mutilations, the rapes, the torture, and everything else that went with it, has now been morphed into another crime. And it's a much more silent crime, and it's a much more insidious genocide that is going on today. But there are still excesses, as they may say. terms of disappearances. There are still assaults. There are still tortures. There are still assassinations going on. But the occupation of Tamil lands has morphed into a much more peaceful suffocation. And by that I mean, when the Tamil Tigers existed, they created a wall that held back the vast majority of the colonisation schemes that held out the military for some time, particularly in the Northern Vanni region. Now that they've been wiped out, the colonial process from the south has accelerated. From the very beginning, as Lee talked about with the colonisation, one of the ways that the Sinhalese majority, which wasn't really about the majority of Sinhalese, it was about the political elites and the religious clerics who believed the island to be only an island of Sinhalese and Buddhists. From the very beginning, they instituted colonisation schemes to try and break down the demographics of the Tamil areas in the east and the north. And the way they talk about it, very similar, the way they talk about Tamils, I should say, it's very similar if people here, left here, has some appreciation of the occupation of Palestine and the way that the Zionists designate Palestinians. It's actually incredibly similar, the way that the Sinhalese chauvinists talk about the nature of Sri Lanka. They say that they are, despite being an 80% majority on the island, they say they're a besieged minority in a holy land that belongs only to them. Besieged in the sense that across the Polk Strait in the southern state of Tamil Nadu in India, there are another 80 million Tamils. And the Sinhalese chauvinists in Sri Lanka say that all Tamils belong in Tamil Nadu, and that any Tamil on the island of Sri Lanka is in effect a fifth column seeking to undermine the holy land of their particular Buddhist faith. So part of the colonisation scheme was to dilute, and to this day is, to dilute Tamil majority areas, to change the demographics, to put wedges in what is Tamil Elam, to break up the contiguity of the territory. And since the fall of the Tigers, this has been proceeding at pace. Lee mentioned that it's not just colonisation schemes, but also the Sinhalisation, i.e. the putting up of the Buddhist monuments, the desecration of Hindu monuments, the bulldozing of the old Tamil Tiger areas, cemeteries, the military occupation of old Tamil lands that continues, the suffocation of the economy under military rule, extends not only to farmers but to fisher people who are pushed further and further towards the coast because Indian and southern trawlers are patrolling the areas to get the best fish, and the most of them are actually fishing the place dry and pushing farmers into poverty. It's even in Jaffna, which is in the north and is the cultural capital of Tamil Elam, there the amount of, I was told when I was there 2 years ago, the amount of Sinhalese capital that has been flowing in and constricting the ability of Tamils to form their own businesses, another way whereby they are attempting to strangle the Tamil nation, economically, culturally, and through demographic transformation and through the land, the ongoing land occupations. All these make for something that in West Papua it's called the silent genocide. It's something resembling a silent genocide. When you cannot go, as I said, 10 kilometres without finding a new military base, and when you've got these colonisation schemes going on thick and fast, there is an entire attempt to undermine the very basis of the Tamil nation. Now, that has not succeeded, but the longer this process goes on, the more it undermines the national claims of Tamils, and the more the nation becomes suffocated under the weight of state-backed That is one of the most, as far as I can tell, that is one of the most dangerous results of the fall of the Tigers. Because when at least you had a national liberation struggle that was fighting for national rights, you had what was basically a bulwark against these schemes. And that bulwark existed really from the late 1970s all the way through to 2009. It put a tremendous brake on the speed or even the ability of the Sri Lankan state and its and the particular chauvinist Buddhist clerical order, which was at the forefront of attempting to break up the Tamil nation, put a tremendous brake on that. And without that resistance, then it is a slow and steady, as I say, suffocation. And I think that that's not going to go away without a fight. And it hasn't been successful at this point, as comrades have said. But I think it is worth, in the context of that, seeing what the Sri Lankan government's project since independence in 1948 of the eradication of Tamil Elam, the eradication of the Tamil nation, the suffocation of the north and Sinhalese dominance. It's important in viewing that to see the role that the Tigers play. I think when you look at, because I think a defence of the Tamil Tigers is absolutely necessary when you see what they were able to achieve, regardless of whether or not you agree with their particular politics, as Lee said. Their rise in the 1970s came in the context of utter failure on the part of the major Tamil political parties to gain even one concession out of the central government in Colombo. A lot of them, the Tamil leadership were older, they were moderates. They believed that if they could only get a seat at the table with the Sinhalese chauvinists in the south, that they would be able to get some crumbs off the table to help protect some of the people in the north. They failed dismally. It came in the context of a radicalising Buddhist clergy and an increasingly chauvinist set of governments after independence who were turning the screws on the Tamil population through a whole series of legal and constitutional changes to make Tamil second-class citizens. And it came, importantly, in the context of the left-wing parties of the south, some of, historically, the biggest far-left organisations in terms of the size of the population that existed anywhere in the world. A huge communist, Trotskyist, far-left, radical, Maoist, whole series of different currents, all of which in their own turn failed dismally on the national question when it came to the Tamils. They either capitulated or were ignorant or turned into some of the most vicious chauvinists themselves. In the context of these three events and the international forces that were lining up to maintain the integrity of what was called the unitary state, i.e. a state that was built by and for Sinhalese and Buddhists and against the Tamils, you would have to be very hard-pressed to make a case that the young radicalising Tamil youth in the north, led by at that time by Velapillai Prabhakaran and others, you'd be hard-pressed to see how they could have seen another way out. They had zero allies in the island, and they had almost zero allies internationally. They turned to the armed struggle because every other avenue that had presented itself had been closed or shown to be a trick or a traitor or a fraud. So the beginning of the armed struggle came not simply out of, as what the West would call, a terrorist bloodlust. It was wholly defensive against every enemy that they faced. And it was wholly successful in mobilising a significant proportion of the population into a national liberation movement that could endure for 30 years to prevent the ongoing Sinhalisation of the north and significantly hold it back in the east. So the rise of the Tigers and what they were able to achieve under incredibly difficult circumstances, I think is something that people on the left should celebrate rather than deride or hold. People can be obviously hold critical support, but when you look at the conditions under which people were fighting, I think the Tamil Tigers did a tremendous service to the people who were backing them. And many of the lies that, incredible amount of lies when you look at it, whether it's that they were terrorists, whether using human shields, whether or not recruiting child soldiers, a whole bunch of things which are absolute distortions from an organisation that had the backing of a significant portion of the population in the north, precisely because they were part of the population of the north. Most families in the north had family members who were in the Tigers because the Tigers had established that you could have a semblance of peace and security under their rule, which you would not get without them being there to defend against the incursions from the south. And I think that's very important. One of the things that comrades say in terms of the international slanders against the Tigers, I'll just note one before I hand over to Aaron. I felt like I need to make a defence of the Tigers today. One of the great slanders, it's not just a slander, it was a weapon used against the Tigers from 2002. It was the question of the use of child soldiers. If you read anything about the peace process in Sri Lanka, you'll read all about the use of child soldiers by the Tamil Tigers and the international community's attempts, along with the Sri Lankan government and NGOs, to stop this practice. This is not a practice. If you talk to any of the Tigers who were recruited, the Tamil Tigers were born as a youth radicalisation. Most of the people who joined the Tigers joined when they were 14, 15, 16. They fought because they wanted to defend themselves and their country, and they fought to become Tigers against the wishes of the more conservative forces. So most of the people who were joining because they wanted to fight, and other people were not doing the fighting. And particularly women comrades in the Tigers who, when I was there 2 years ago, you speak to the ex-cadre, they talked about the problems and the difficulties some of them had with their own families. They wanted to defend themselves, and their families, who were older and more conservative, were not willing to fight. So it was the young people who were fighting. And when the international community came in and said, you cannot have child soldiers, they're attempting to cut the Tigers off at the base because it was a youth movement. And when the international community said, we are going to have regulations around the recruitment of child soldiers, they had a duplicitous, a double standard, I should say. They said that if you're a state actor, you may not forcibly recruit anyone under the age of 18. They said if you're a non-state actor, you may not have anyone under the age of 18. So effectively they said the Sri Lankan government can conscript 16-year-olds, but young radical Tamils are not allowed to join the Tigers. That's how they used the issue of child recruitment from 2002 all the way through to the restarting of the war in 2006, the 3 years of which led to the utter obliteration of the Tiger leadership and the leading cadres under the auspices of the international community, who all watched it happen, packed up their bags and left when the war started, came back in when the war ended, tut-tutted a bit, but all then rallied around the idea of a unitary state and the government. I'm going to leave it at that. But it's infuriating, some of these rumours and lies and malicious things that get said.
Thank you, Ben Hillier, and you've put a lot on the table, and I think we've probably got a lot to discuss. And I think we'll all be looking forward to the publication of your book, which is imminent. In fact, it was supposed to be launched today, I think. it's on the way, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Okay, now our final speaker, somebody with a long record of solidarity, activism, and passion, Arun Mavagan, who will be looking at it from the perspective, not from the outside, but from the inside.
Helen, it's going to be very difficult to match Ben.
Come on.
May 2009 was a massive and tragic event for Tamils around the world, including here in Australia. The biggest mobilizations of Ulam Tamils in the diaspora happened then and not since. Hundreds of thousands of Tamils took to the streets to try and stop the killings, but it wasn't successful. It was a massive setback to the Tamil fight for self-determination. The theme of my comments is, who are the Tamil friends and who are their enemies? It's been 10 years, and I don't think Tamils in the diaspora or in the homeland are conscious of this. I think this is the key for Tamils to work out how to continue the struggle for self-determination. Over the last 10 years, we have all been trying to understand how the international community allowed such an atrocity to be carried out against the Ulam Tamils in 2009. I have struggled to understand the role played by various international players. We now know, as Helen mentioned, the US and UK were complicit in the genocide, and India played an active role. Since the war ended, we often look to the agencies in the control of these powers for help. Understanding who these agencies are and their role in ongoing oppression is important for us to continue our fight back. Final days of the war are framed as a civil war in which war crimes were committed on both sides. This has been the framing by the United Nations and other international non-governmental organizations and Western states. No one has challenged it, like Helen said, except the People's Tribunal and some other groups. It's not framed as a national liberation war. And as Helen mentioned, Permanent People's Tribunal found what happened in 2009 as genocide. Following that, we had the Northern Provincial Council in 2015 passing a resolution calling the attacks in 2009 as genocide, not only as a genocide, but also a historic and ongoing process, but no international actors are willing to call it so. The UN, Human Rights Watch, International Crisis Group, Amnesty International, none of these groups has said anything about genocide. While these groups are happy to recognize killings, for example, in Bosnia as genocide, as the US and other states do, they're unwilling to do so in our case. They are unwilling to say anything about the right to self-determination either. While the Tamil community here and in the rest of diaspora are seeking justice from these agencies, our struggle was being used by Western governments to get rid of the Rajapaksa government and replace him with the Western ally. But at the same time, they were also grateful for the role Rajapaksa played in wiping out LTTE. As part of their strategy to get rid of Rajapaksa, the United Nations Human Rights Council worked on a resolution to investigate war crimes. This resolution was limited in its ability to get justice for the Tamil people. The resolution was to be reviewed in March 2015. Sri Sena got elected in January 2015. As soon as Sri Sena was elected, the narrative of the UN Human Rights Council changed. The resolution that was weak in the first place, was weakened even further, and Sri Lanka was given more time to investigate itself. An international investigation became a hybrid investigation and then a domestic investigation. Now it's at that point where the call for an investigation could be dropped altogether. We should also know that while we're talking about these international actors, organizations like International Monetary Fund, World Bank, and other corporations are aiding the Sri Lankan state. Thanks to WikiLeaks, we now know that the International Monetary Fund was determined to see the Tigers wiped out, even if it meant heavy loss of lives. Our failure to understand the role of these players is delaying the justice and diverting our people's focus on fighting the ongoing oppression. Tamil diaspora is full of people who are promoting the United Nations and other agencies and non-governmental organizations that are acting in the interest of Western governments. A lot of effort by the Tamil diaspora goes into convincing Western governments to take sympathetic stand on the Tamil issue. We send so many people to every session of the UN Human Rights Council. We're obsessed with seeking justice from the very people who are ultimately responsible for the killings. We must never forget that their resolutions say nothing about genocide, nothing about self-determination. It talks about human rights and torture, but it does nothing to explain the causes of these abuses, which is the denial of Ulam Tamil's legitimacy on the island. Yet, we celebrate it as hard-fought win for our diplomacy. Western governments have been promoting Tamil organizations like the Global Tamil Forum that have very little support amongst the Tamils in the diaspora, and these organizations are then used to promote key leaders in the Tamil National Alliance. During the last parliamentary election, we had community leaders, so-called community leaders, here taking out newspaper ads endorsing the Tamil National Alliance leadership that has been openly supporting Western governments. Tamil leadership have been unashamedly working with the people who are continuing to oppress the Tamils. Currently, in southern Sri Lanka, we have Sri Sena Ranil Alliance and the Rajapaksa brothers in opposition. Since coming into power, Sri Sena has made few cosmetic changes. This has given the Western powers enough points to promote him. On the substantive issues, such as the military occupation of the North and East, military impunity for heinous crimes against the civilian population, and a point-blank refusal to allow an international investigation into war crimes, he is at one with Rajapaksa. While Tamil leaders in the Tamil National Alliance are comfortable with their cozy relationship with these war criminals, we find leadership among the people at the grassroots level. In February 2017, people of Cape Papalovu showed us that only through mass mobilizations can we force the Sri Lankan state to abandon their genocidal policies. Also, another significant resistance was the fight for their land by the people of Iranadivu, a tiny island in the north. After 359 days of protesting on the mainland near Kulinochi, over 300 demonstrators decided to take their land back by sailing to the island and confront the navy that was occupying their land. In doing so, they reclaimed their land on 23rd of April 2018. While the people of Iranadivu continue to struggle without basic facilities, their brave and daring demonstration is another example of how we should approach the fight for the rights of our people. There are strong movements in support of the Tamil political prisoners and the disappeared. People in the homeland are continuing to look for ways to build alliances in the South. They realize the need to reach out to the working single people, discuss and cultivate mutual solidarity. Over the last 60 years, as we struggle with the genocidal Sri Lankan state, Sinhala people have also lost so much in the hands of the state. Ongoing genocidal agenda of the Sri Lankan state only serves the interest of Sri Lanka's elite and imperialist powers. It is time for progressive Sinhala groups to show leadership on the Tamil national question. A way forward is recognizing the traditional Tamil homeland on the island and the Tamils' right to self-determination, which could take many forms, but must include the right to secession. This is the only way we can overcome the tension between the two national groups and create a platform for working class unity. We look to progressive section of the international community to use your connections in the South to help promote this. And Tamils must always remember that our national liberation struggle will mean very little if we are not conscious of the class struggle and the struggle for internationalism. There is hope for us if the masses of the Sinhala nation can see through the lies of the Sri Lankan state. Thank you.